WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Tourists in the 19th century made pilgrimages to natural wonders like Niagara Falls and Yosemite, but they also found prisons, insane asylums, and cemeteries worth the journey. In his new book, Sacred Places, John Sears traces the development of tourist attractions and the role they played in American culture. His book begins in the 1820s with the rise of tourism and brings us up to date with what he sees as the significance of Graceland and the Vietnam Memorial. I ask John Sears how tourism in the last century differed from today.
We were a culture in search of an identity. We were criticized by Europeans for not having any culture, that we didn't have any great painters or great writers or great sculptors. And Americans were very self-conscious about that, had a sense of cultural inferiority. And they were looking for opportunities to develop a distinctive American culture, but also a culture that would somehow meet European expectations. And tourism provided one of the ways of doing that. So that what struck me about the 19th century was the number of writers and artists who were engaged in visiting and depicting the major and also the minor tourist attractions of the age. And their acts of painting and writing would make the places famous and confer cultural significance upon them.
You've described and researched some of the sites that tourists would visit in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s. The guidebooks urge tourists to see new prisons, mm-hmm. insane asylums, and right. institutions for the deaf, dumb, and the blind.
Right.
These aren't usually on your package tours nowadays.
No, they're not. And they were only really fairly briefly then, for a couple of decades, I would say. And it was because these were new institutions. It was an age of reform. It was an age when there was a lot of optimism about the transformation of human nature through methods of education, methods of treatment for people with disabilities or people who were criminals. And there had been nothing like these institutions. They were much bigger in scale. They were much more sophisticated in terms of the methods they used, and people went to see them for that reason.
What kind of tourist would go to a prison? Would it have been somebody who had money and the leisure to travel, or was this a day tripper?
I think most of the tourists before the Civil War were well-to-do. It was expensive to travel. It took a lot of time, so that you had to have quite a lot of leisure if you wanted to get to Niagara Falls. A lot of people who went there before the Civil War spent a week or more. It was more like a resort in that way. So it wasn't until after the Civil War when railroad fares fell and there was a growing class of clerks and bureaucrats in the city who had some leisure and some money and were now able to travel on shorter trips that the trains allowed to these places.
The attitudes of the 19th century toward natural sites somehow seems different than ours. Often we view the out of doors as a sacred place not to be violated. Yet there were places such as Mauch Chunk in Pennsylvania where tourists actually went to see a working mine, mm-hmm. as a site. What were attitudes about visiting places such as Mauch Chunk?
Well, I think, first of all, in the 19th century, Americans generally were very optimistic about industrialization and technology, very excited about it, excited about what was happening with the building of the railroads and the mining of coal and the development of the country. And they weren't yet, very few Americans were concerned about the effect of these operations on the environment or even on the workers who were involved.
Some of the artists that you quote at the time and other historians whose comments you've taken from their histories and guidebooks of the era talk about the beauty of the landscape with the mill and that somehow the painting or the scene is disrupted if labor is pictured in it, if there's sort of a human worker in the scene, there is something lovely about the landscape and the plant.
Mm-hmm.
Why was labor sort of seen as an intrusion?
Well, I don't think it always was. I think some writers saw that, but other writers who loved what they called the 19th century the picturesque, which word we still use, but had a lot more resonance in the 19th century. And the picturesque did include evidence of human activity. Peasants in Europe were considered picturesque, gypsies in particular, people who were in some way unusual, exotic, colorful. And you find American travel writers and writing about blacks in this way as adding picturesque touches to a scene. And in Mauk Chunk, they looked at the Breaker Boys this way as picturesque. They didn't see at that time that there was anything wrong with child labor.
What are Breaker Boys?
They were boys who picked the slate out of the coal in the breakers, which were at the top of the mine. When the coal came up from the mine, it was run through these sorting systems, and the boys would sit on benches with no backs for long hours. These were boys about 10, and pick the slate out. The tourists who went to Mauk Chunk would actually see these kids in action, and they thought they were cute.
The Amish in Pennsylvania are also a tourist attraction, kind of like the Breaker Boys, and are regarded as picturesque, and I suppose to some extent even the Navajo and the Hopi, you know, in the Southwest.
Right, and that can be a problem for those people, though they can sometimes benefit from it, but it also can be a problem. I'll never forget the experience of going to Niagara Falls and going behind the falls, where you put on these raincoats and rain hats. And when we ascended, when we came out after this experience, everybody was taking off their raincoats. And standing next to me was a family of Amish who had been to visit the falls as tourists. And I thought that was a fascinating reversal of roles, that they could be tourists too.
There are these national monuments, these national places, these sacred places, I guess, such as Yellowstone and Yosemite, Niagara Falls, that people like to visit and sort of check off a life list of significant places in this country that they have been to, mm-hmm. To have what seems like a shared experience. But sometimes when people go to a place such as the Grand Canyon and find that it's raining and doesn't look at all like a postcard,
mm-hmm.
That they're disappointed in the visit,
mm-hmm.
that somehow they need to be at the rim of the canyon and have it look like the photograph that they've seen,
right,
rather than see it with their own eyes.
Right.
What is going on here?
Well, I think that's a very interesting aspect of tourism, and that's why these paintings and photographs and written descriptions were so important in the 19th century, that the tourist often brought with them, and the tourists today do that too, as you say. They bring with them a preconception of what the place is supposed to look like and also what they're supposed to feel when they're there. You know, if you go to Disneyland, you're supposed to have fun. Human nature being what it is, people often don't have the experience that they expected or were told they should have by the advertising, and then they're disappointed. And I think that's a very common tourist experience. It seemed especially apparent in the 19th century in people's responses to Niagara Falls. There were many writers who felt that they couldn't experience it. They didn't feel overwhelmed. They didn't feel transformed. They didn't feel religious experience. The experience of the sublime, as it's described, sounds very similar to the descriptions of the conversion experience, which was also an experience that 19th century people were familiar with.
That's an interesting idea. The travel brochure in Promise has religious literature. You know, that tourism will be a transcendental experience for you.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly in the 19th century, it was advertised that way, and And then if you didn't have the experience, you felt somehow inadequate.
Well, I knew you were talking about visiting Disneyland, and I know when I visited Disneyland and other theme parks, yes, you can have fun, but I also got tremendously dismayed at a sense of control that I felt going on.
Right, right.
You know, your entertainment was highly structured for you while you were there.
Yes, very much so.
You sound drawn more toward human-built attractions than to the wilderness areas.
Well, I think I am in some ways. I find them interesting. I think one of the most interesting sites today is the Vietnam Memorial, which is in some way functions as a tourist attraction. In some ways, it's more than that because it's very personal to people. People have lost people in the war. But it's also functions as the way the Willie House did in the 19th century, which was a monument to a family who had been lost in an avalanche. And it certainly functions as a sacred place. And I found it very moving to visit it.
Well, John Sears, thank you very much for being an oral guide to seven sacred places for us.
Okay. Well, it's been nice to be on the show.
John Sears is the author of Sacred Places, American Tourist Attractions in the 19th Century. It's published by Oxford University Press.